The House will come to order. Speaker Ryan has the gavel. What that might mean for the economy if he decides to take the job. Also, part two of our talk with Charles Koch, why he believes what he believes. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you along today, everybody. It's the 22nd of October, Thursday. The spotlights and the television cameras in Washington today were pretty much all on the Hillary Clinton-Benghazi hearings. Elsewhere in democracy, though, it appears Paul Ryan has locked up the endorsements and support from all the various factions in the House of Representatives, in the Republican Party in the House, that is, and so will be the next speaker, again, if he decides he wants that job. Ryan is arguably one of the biggest fiscal policy wonks in Congress. So, in the most powerful job in Congress with a history of reaching across the aisle, what might economic policy under a Speaker Ryan look like? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
Paul Ryan hasn't even gotten the job yet, and conservatives are fighting over his politics. Is he conservative enough or is he not? Lindsay Kashkarian is research director with the nonpartisan National Priorities Project.
Paul Ryan has been a fiscal conservative, but he has also been a compromiser, and he has worked across the aisle.
So, what to expect from a speaker, Ryan?
A relatively safe pair of hands.
This is the view of Eurasia Group analyst Corey Bowles. What he means is that Ryan can steer clear of total legislative meltdowns and stalemates.
Ryan's one of the few people who has the political smarts and the respect of his Republican colleagues in the House to navigate those fiscal shoals and avoid a likely government shutdown.
Avoiding things is one thing. Making things happen is another. Michael Strain is an economist at the American Enterprise Institute.
Paul Ryan, as the speaker, makes things like Medicare reform or like tax reform marginally more likely.
That's in part, says Strain, because Ryan is more intimately familiar with these issues than many of his colleagues. As speaker, he could help push these items onto the table. That does not mean, however, that he can make them pass.
Legislation capable of moving through the Senate with 60 votes is unlikely to emerge because he's going to need also 124 Republicans in the House to support it.
Henrietta Trays is an analyst with Height Securities.
And there just aren't that many middle-of-the-road Republicans right now.
Paul Ryan is a conservative and a compromiser, but not a magician. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Today, the White House laid out its plans to try to help Puerto Rico fix its debt problems. The territory has been called America's Greece for months now, and in some measures, that's true. Like Greece, Puerto Rico is under a mountain of debt. A safe estimate puts it at more than $72 billion. There, though, the comparisons end and Puerto Rico's fiscal problems begin, as Marketplace's Andy Euler explains.
Back in 1898, American soldiers invaded Puerto Rico in the Spanish-American War. Later that year, the Treaty of Paris made the island U.S. territory. Rafael Cox Alomar says not a lot has changed since then. He's a law professor at the University of the District of Columbia and is writing a book called The Puerto Rico Constitution.
Basically, Congress makes decisions on behalf of Puerto Rico without our explicit consent. Not only is this indecent and colonial, but it really doesn't serve well the economic upliftment of the people of Puerto Rico.
He says Puerto Rico's business community is subject to regulation that most states don't have to worry about, like the Jones Act, which says that anything shipped between the island and any U.S. port has to go on an American ship. Corporate investment is also down. Charles Venator Santiago teaches political science at the University of Connecticut.
You have to sort of find a way to balance the cycle between labor and corporate investment. The more recent measures taken are sort of focused on austerity measures, which eliminate the ability or reduce the ability of workers in Puerto Rico to work.
Puerto Rico's unemployment hovers around 14%. 45% of the population lives under the poverty level. The central government says it will run out of cash to provide basic services in a couple of weeks. Again, Rafael Cox Alomar.
And I do not believe the administration is realizing that the fundamental problem that Puerto Rico faces is both a fiscal problem but also a political problem.
The Obama administration's plan would give the island access to bankruptcy protection it now lacks. Legally, it changes nothing. That would require an act of Congress. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, oh my goodness, traders found their buy buttons. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We spent a big chunk of the program yesterday on my interview with Charles Koch, the CEO of Koch Industries and a leader, arguably the leader, along with his brother David, of political fundraising for Republican and libertarian causes and candidates in this country. I pushed him about money and his political influence. He pushed back.
You look at the Republican debate. Do you see the things I've been talking about in the debate? You see people saying these things that I'm saying? So how am I influencing the debate?
Today, exactly what Charles Koch believes and why. It's part of what he lays out in his new book, Good Profit. It's about his life and the company he runs, and that's where we started when we talked last week in his office in Wichita. Here you are, almost 80 years old, right? 1st of November?
Yeah.
You're working in the company your father founded or built. His picture's over there, big portrait.
That's right, absolutely.
There's a bust of him out in the hallway, right?
Yeah.
Still a factor in your life, then your dad.
Well, yeah, because he taught me the basic values that guide our company, guide everything I do. I remember what it was like growing up under him. Like starting at age 6, he had me working virtually all my spare time. And I don't mean doing easy stuff. Like he started out at age 6 digging dandelions at 100-degree temperature. And I'm thinking, why my father hate me and all my friends' fathers love them because they're out swimming and having a great time, and here I am.
So he was tough, your old man was.
So he was tough. Yeah, one of his – well, his philosophy was this. He said, I don't want my sons to be country club bums. Huh. He taught me a work ethic.
Huh. The book is called Good Profit, in which you talk about entrepreneurship – that is principled. How do you do that in this economy today?
Well, I mean, it's not easy because the economy is so riddled with corporate welfare and anti-competitive regulations, anti-innovation regulations, regulations that are destroying opportunities for the disadvantaged, which is creating this two-tiered system we're headed for. What we do is focus on creating value for others. And how do we do that? We do it by trying to produce products and services that our customers will value more than their alternatives, and not just their alternatives today, but what the alternatives will be in the future.
I need to back you up to that whole corporate welfare and the state of society today, because that's, in essence, what you're talking about with people who are advantaged and disadvantaged. It's not possible that you don't see that Koch Industries has benefited from some of those policies that the government has in place today.
Oh, terrific. I mean, you can't help. I mean, you're hurt by some and benefit by others. I mean, look at all the ways, all the forms of corporate welfare. There are cash subsidies, there are loan guarantees, there are import tariffs, there are regulations on your competitors.
Right. And my point is that Koch Industries benefits from all of those.
Well, I mean, some cases we benefit, some we're hurt, but we're opposed to all of them.
So before we move on, I want to make sure I understand. If all government support for oil and gas industries, which is what this company was built on, or all
government... Well, not totally, but in part.
In part, okay.
That's how it started.
Exactly. So support for oil and gas industries, support for lumber and timber and paper products, which this company now owns with Georgia Pacific. If that all went away tomorrow, you'd be all right.
Absolutely. We oppose all of it. And that is an altruistic. That's the way we believe we all do better. Because for business to survive over a long period, it needs to be contributing to society and people's well-being. Otherwise, who's going to want it?
I wonder whether your definition of society's well-being isn't necessarily everybody's definition of society's well-being. You've got your view here from this from this very successful large company that you run.
But that's not where my view came from the company. The way I run the company came from my study of relevant disciplines from all different perspectives over a year on how people can best live and work together to make their lives better. With all the technologies out there now, we have the potential to have the best lives for everybody than anybody ever dreamed of.
But wait, warts and all, and there are many of them in this society and economy, we are, by any measure you can think of, the richest, most powerful society in the history of the planet. Is that not good enough for you?
Well, no, we're not the richest anymore or have the most benefit. I mean, other places do. Other places are freer and so on.
But come on. That just doesn't stand up to reason.
Well, it's true. We don't have the highest median income. We don't have the most economic freedom. We were, before the Bush administration, we were third. Now we've dropped, depending on which measure, to 16th. And that correlates very well with prosperity. Doesn't that bother you that the median income and the income of the least advantage is going down? That you're okay with that? I'm not. That's what I want to change.
Let me ask you, though, whether you understand that people look at you and Koch Industries and say, well, of course he wants government out of the way because he's ginormous and he can steamroll us and do whatever he wants.
Well, if that's so, why are we about the only large company that's taking this position? Most companies want free enterprise in general because that produces better goods and services and make people's lives better, but they don't want it in their business. They want protection from competition. They want subsidies. They want the government to pick winners and losers, and they want to be picked as winners. And that's what we're opposing, and that's what drives my whole efforts in policy and in the political arena.
Does government do any good in the economy?
Yeah. The government is the agency that has the legal monopoly of force. And you say, well, God, that's bad. No, we need force to protect the U.S. from attack, to protect people's person and property. And in certain other things, when force works better than voluntary cooperation and competition. And so that, to me, is the test. But the government has gone way over in using force, and we see that in the criminal justice system, where we have 5% of the world population and 25% of the world's prison population. Now, obviously, we're using a lot more force than other countries we look down on, so we need to reform it. So it doesn't create these obstacles to the disadvantaged becoming productive, contributing citizens and just sit there on the dole. And I don't believe for a minute people want that. They say, well, people are lazy. Yeah, because you block all opportunities. They smoke a joint and they go to prison and they can't get a job. They're ruined. Whereas we have a president who smoked a joint, and he becomes president. We have a candidate who says he smoked a joint. He's running for president. Now, what's the equity? What's the fairness in that?
We started with your dad. Let me end with your dad. Let's say he comes back to life and walks into Wichita 2015 and comes to the Koch Tower here on the campus. What does he say to you?
You say, holy mackerel. No, but it's, I mean, I'm the same way. When I first came with the company, being mathematical, I said, okay, if I can implement my ideas here, here's how much I think we can grow. And I plotted that out till my retirement. And 2 years ago, we exceeded my lifetime goal by 70-fold. So I can't believe it.
Charles Koch, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
We had, all told, an hour with Mr. Koch in his office. The tape runs 1 hour and 4 minutes, to be precise. We've cut it down to about 30 minutes or so for the latest episode of our Corner Office podcast. There's a link on our website, or you can get it on iTunes or wherever you do get your podcast. If you want to hear the whole thing, the whole hour and four, you can do that, too. We talked about Uber, how he and his wife still live in the same house they built 40 years ago. Also, at one point, he quotes Vladimir Lenin. It's a pretty good interview, if I say so myself. Marketplace.org. Coming up.
And there are about 80 companies that are valued at $1 billion or more. And you now have this whole industry of people saying, hey, maybe that's a little too much.
Yeah, maybe. But first, let's do the numbers. Oh my, the happy music. Wow. Dow up 320 points today. Caught me off guard. 1.8%, 17,489 at the close. The NASDAQ gained 79 points, 1.6%, 4920. The S&P 500 added 33 points, also 1.6%, 2052. Happy times over those Happy Meals. McDonald's buzzed up 8% today after the world's biggest burger chain said its sales increased in the last quarter. You can leave home without it. You really can, or at least you have recently. American Express reduced 5.2% today after reporting a sharp dip in profits. Visa charged up 1.25%, though. Nike today, basically flat. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.02%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. Whirlpool and American Airlines are scheduled to report quarterly earnings. Comedian and talk show host Johnny Carson was born on October 23, 1925. He would have been 90. And workshops at this event include understanding espresso machines and Tea 101. Coffee Fest Portland gets underway at the Oregon Convention Center. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You remember that big Pacific trade deal we've been telling you so much about? The one with 12 countries, 40% of global GDP, wrapped up in Atlanta earlier this month? That one? Yeah, well, sad to say, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is old news. We've got new trade talks to tell you about. The Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, TTIP for short, is what it's called. The players this time are the U.S. and Europe, which is, yes, already one of our biggest trading partners. Negotiators are down in Miami as we speak, but as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains, this deal still has a long, long way to go.
TTIP, TPP, here's a pitch for why you should care about these alphabet soup trade deals. This is John Gillingham, a fellow at the Harvard Center for European Studies.
You can be for it, you can be against it, but you should be aware of the fact that the implications of it extend far beyond talks about, you know, trade and tariffs. It is going to provide a kind of economic constitution globally.
If both agreements are finalized, the Pacific deal still needs to get through Congress. It's maybe halftime in European negotiations. And those talks are not a copy-paste of the newly finished Pacific ones, says Susan Ariel Aronson. She's a professor at George Washington University.
Basically, these are wealthy, industrialized countries with good governance. And so we're really arguing over the type of regulation and how to regulate.
Interestingly, I think this deal is harder for the Europeans than it is for the Americans.
Edward Alden is with the Council on Foreign Relations. He says in the Trans-Pacific deal, opponents worried about diluting U.S. standards on things like labor and the environment. Now in the Trans-Atlantic, it's Europeans worried about weaker U.S. standards tied to issues like consumer safety and health.
We clean our chicken, for instance, in mild chlorine baths to get rid of bacteria and other things. The Europeans find that appalling. We eat all sorts of crops made from genetically modified seeds. European consumers don't like that at all.
There's already been a series of protests against TTIP in Europe, including at least 150,000 people in Berlin earlier this month. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The U.S. Marshals Service is going to hold its last auction of Silk Road bitcoins early next month. The Marshals seized more than 44,000 bitcoin today, worth a bit more than $12 million when it shut down the underground website a couple of years ago. It was a channel for buying and selling drugs, fake documents, a whole bunch of stuff. The bitcoins are the tangible leftovers, even though, yes, they are virtual, I get that. And they have been snapped up in a series of auctions. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more now on the business of bitcoin.
Let's just get one thing straight. The Marshall Service did not become the world's biggest Bitcoin owner when it seized the Silk Road Bitcoin.
Almost certainly not.
That's Peter Van Valkenburg, director of research at Coin Center, a think tank and Bitcoin advocacy group in Washington. He says it would be difficult, if not impossible, to say who owns the most Bitcoins. You have to look at Bitcoin ownership in a broader sense, in groups. Van Valkenburg says the earliest Bitcoin makers probably still own a bunch.
When this technology was new, it was a lot of garage innovators who were just playing around with something on their PC. And a lot of those people ended up holding a lot of the Bitcoin.
Other big Bitcoin holders, hedge funds, which invest in Bitcoins themselves or hold them for clients. Gil Luria is a managing director at Wedbush Securities.
Individual investors and some institutional investors chose to hold the Bitcoin through these entities. And so these entities own a lot of Bitcoin directly.
But exactly how much? Who knows? Which, of course, is the point of Bitcoin, says Andy Schmidt, a principal executive advisor at CEB Tower Group who follows Bitcoin.
The anonymous nature, or largely anonymous nature, of Bitcoins is what makes it particularly attractive.
Notice Schmidt says largely anonymous. The U.S. government can track Bitcoin owners down. It's hard, but not impossible. Just ask the owner of Silk Road. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There's been an interesting development in the lexicon of Silicon Valley the past couple of years, a new way to identify startups that have become successful, very successful, I should say, valued at $1 billion or more. They're called unicorns, long sought after mythical creatures. You get the connection, I hope. Except lately, there has been more and more speculation that maybe, just possibly, the valuation of some of these companies is about as real as unicorns. We got our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, on the phone to discuss. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai, how are you?
I'm well, but I'm disappointed to learn that there may not actually be such things as unicorns.
Isn't it amazing how we want that? We want to believe. We do. It's not that there are no such thing as unicorns, but that they may, in fact, be really rare. Obviously, what we're talking about here is these companies that are valued at $1 billion or more. And it seems like it should be harder to get to that valuation. Yeah. There are about 80 companies that are valued at $1 billion or more. And you now have this whole industry of people saying, hey, maybe that's a little too much, because these companies, a lot of them have low margins. Or just this week, actually, a very famous venture capitalist, Fred Wilson, said that a lot of these companies have negative gross margins. They're selling products for less than it costs to make them.
What is going on then in the Valley that somehow the veil has been dropped from people's eyes? Or is it something fundamental, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I think much like Wall Street is an emotional thing, you know, you want to believe it's all the numbers and the actual business models, but it's not. And I think one of the things that's happening in the Valley is a change in attitude. People are starting to feel like this has gotten out of hand. A lot of them are saying, hey, maybe we need to pull back. And I think that's reasonable. What they're realizing is that they're funding a lot of companies that do exactly the same thing, and that the business models are not proven on top of that. So there can only be so many Tinder clones. Or maybe it wasn't a good idea to give $30 million to that app Secret, which was really just about gossiping anonymously. That maybe that's not business. And these venture capitalists are starting to say, we've gone a little too far and it's time to pull back. And that's the kind of change in feeling that can have a really broad impact.
Which I totally get. And not to pat myself on the back here too much, but I was saying to people 18 months or 2 years ago, hello, bubble, and just now they're catching up?
Well, you know, Marc Andreessen actually tweeted today.
Yeah, another famous venture capitalist, right?
Another famous venture capitalist, exactly. He's on the other side. And he's saying, look, people have been talking about a bubble for 13 years.
Right.
And that's true. We're all scarred a little bit. And a lot of venture capitalists will say, there's no problem. That we're not in a bubble and there's not going to be a crash. And in fact, they will point to the fact that spending, venture capital spending in the third quarter was way up in the Bay Area. But you could also argue that that's a sign of a bubble. So you've got people saying, listen, we're going to pull back. Maybe that'll keep it from turning into a full-blown crash. But the fact is, there's sort of a little bit of common sense here. Like you said, you just look at it and you go, this isn't right. And it can't last forever. It never has and it never will.
And that's the lesson. There we are. Never going to last?
No, never going to last. Never. You know, you're going to see some changes. You absolutely are. People are flat out saying, the people who control the money are saying, we're not going to keep handing this money out like candy. And let's say you got 30 companies that would have gotten $5 million each last year. They don't get that money this year. That's a lot more people who suddenly don't have jobs, who don't come to the Bay Area, who don't need apartments, don't need office space. That's going to have an impact.
Yeah, no, I get that. But what about the whole fear of missing out thing that is so prevalent both in venture capitalism, right, but also in the startup mentality in the Valley?
Yeah, there's no question that people are going to keep coming here trying to seek their fortune, and that's what could make a crash worse. But it's that unchecked optimism that's starting to be checked.
And when you put it that way, checked optimism isn't so bad, right?
Checked optimism is a good idea. I mean, it's a good idea to weed out some of those $5 million startup ideas that are frankly terrible. We're overdue for this conversation.
And here we are having it today. Molly Wood is our senior tech correspondent. Thanks, Molly.
My pleasure, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, in which Airbnb has a public relations fail in a very big way. The company is fighting back against a ballot proposition in San Francisco that would restrict the kind of short-term rentals that company's very business model is based on. So yesterday, Airbnb put up a whole bunch of ads pointing out that the company generates $12 million in tax receipts for the city. Ads saying things like, and this is a quote, "Dear parking enforcement, please use the $12 million in hotel taxes to feed all expired parking meters. Love, Airbnb. Also, dear public library system, we hope you use some of the $12 million in hotel taxes to keep the library open later. Love, Airbnb." Social media reaction was swift and, as social media reaction tends to be, harsh. The company has apologized and said it's going to take the ads down. The happy music caught me off guard today. The Dow up 320 points, about 1.8%. The NASDAQ up 79 points. The S&P 500 gained 33 points. Both of those 1.6%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.